This is Messianic Judaism 10, where we'll be talking about the Third Temple, circumcision, keeping kosher, and various other emphases in Messianic Judaism. Earlier, we've seen that many key features of the old do not translate directly into the new. Now, I'm not talking about some moral considerations and some theological truths. For example, you're not allowed to hate your enemy in the Old Testament or the New. There's one God in the Old Testament and the New. I don't mean things like that. Although most aspects of the Torah, most of those regulations, are no longer required, all of them point to Christ. They come to full fruition in Christ, as we saw in Class 3. For example, we talked about animal sacrifice, warfare, priesthood, and tithing, just very briefly here. There's no forgiveness without the shedding of blood, and almost everything is purified with blood under the old law, Hebrews 9:22. The law is a shadow, Hebrews 10:4. Real forgiveness did not come through those animal sacrifices. That's not to say that people weren't forgiven. They were actually forgiven because of the future sacrifice of Christ, but there's no forgiveness through the blood of bulls and goats, Hebrews 10:18. Warfare. So we're no longer permitted to kill our enemies, and the church is no longer a political entity. So multiple aspects, not just related to fighting or killing, but just to politics in general and economics, don't translate very well from one covenant to the other. The priesthood, of course, is defunct. Well, we could say all Christians are priests, or we could say Jesus only is the priest, the high priest. But since we're all in the ministry, we don't talk about certain Christians being priests and others not. Tithing was another example we gave. It's not found in the New Testament, except in two passages referring to the old law in Matthew 23 and Hebrews 7. We're no longer an agrarian church state, and thus we are released from the law of tithe. Although in the Middle Ages, the church brought it back and actually turned it into a tax. Oh boy. So I like to look at three further teachings in a bit more detail, and then we'll go quickly through a few more. So let's give a little time to circumcision and the Third Temple and kashrut, or keeping kosher. How about circumcision? In Acts 15, we came across certain Christians who said that you must be circumcised to be saved. They wanted to make sure that all the new believers, all those who were coming to faith among the Gentiles, would be circumcised, and then they could be baptized and be saved. Now, anyone who doubts whether circumcision is optional or not, I say it's totally optional. The Messianics wouldn't say that. Please listen to our next lesson from Galatians. You'll see. And I'll just read one verse here. Paul, 1 Corinthians 7, 18-19. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. Was a man uncircumcised when he is called? He should not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Now, with that kind of view, you can understand why it made some Jewish background Christians uncomfortable. And it made many Jews uncomfortable, because circumcision is one of the most distinctive markers, at least for males, as they keep Torah. And even though Messianics encourage circumcision, they're wrong on that. We shouldn't let ourselves be pressured into circumcision any more than we should be pressured into tithing or treating someone as a holy priest when only Jesus is our high priest. What about the Third Temple? The first temple was that built by Solomon. In earlier centuries, the Lord appeared through the tabernacle that was built as Moses got the instructions from God directly. The temple was made of stone. The tabernacle is basically a portable temple. But we have the first temple of Solomon, and so that's finished in early in the 10th century BC, but it's destroyed by the Babylonians in 587. A new temple is built, the second temple. And this is completed around the year 515. We read about this, for example, in the little book of Haggai. That temple was greatly expanded, starting in the first century BC, by Herod the Great, who was an engineer, among other things, or certainly a great patron of engineering, he built many structures and cities, and the temple was far more impressive in Jesus' day, probably even than it was in Solomon's day. But that temple was destroyed by the Romans. Revolution broke out in Galilee in the 60s. There was a war. It was pretty much over in 4 years, but it culminated with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. So what's the third temple? Well, there are some Jews and there are some Christians who believe that the temple must be rebuilt. Sometimes they argue that because at the end of Ezekiel, we have dimensions of the holy land and the holy temple. These, I think, are symbolic dimensions, symbolic numbers. If you look at it geographically, it actually wouldn't work. But they take what is, I think most scholars would think, is a very figurative passage. That is the end of Ezekiel, last 9 chapters. And they take it very literally. Well, that's never happened, so the third temple hasn't been built. And so some think, yeah, the temple needs to be built again, and we need to have animal sacrifices again. I'm not sure how many messianics would say animal sacrifices will be restored, or will it be a vegetarian substitute? I really don't know. People think it needs to be rebuilt, though, on the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is that huge area, the most famous part of Jerusalem, where there's a mosque now, the Aqsa Mosque, and also the famous Dome of the Rock, which is covered with gold, the most visible structure there. And most Jews and Christians who go for the third temple thing say it will be built exactly where the Dome of the Rock is. Some say maybe just slightly north of it, but everyone has it happening around the Temple Mount. Well, why does it need to be rebuilt? We've talked twice already about Acts 15, summing up the discussions of the Council of Jerusalem, and James is presiding, James the brother of Jesus, and he cites Amos 9:11, an 8th century prophecy about rebuilding David's fallen tent. Let me just read Acts 15:14-17. Simon has described to us how God first intervened to choose a people for his name from the Gentiles. The words of the prophets are in agreement with this, as it is written, "After this I will return and rebuild David's fallen tent. Its ruins I will rebuild, and I will restore it, that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who bear my name." Okay, so what's happening here? What is James saying? He's saying that David's fallen tent is being rebuilt. He's not saying it has to happen yet. He's describing what's happening right then. That is, God's people are obeying him, and they're getting the word out to all nations. We have that phrase, the rest of mankind, namely all the Gentiles who bear my name. And also, he used that phrase, restore, the ruins of David's fallen tent. And by the way, in David's lifetime, it was just a tabernacle, but soon after it was the temple. What's fallen here, the physical temple stood at this time, but morally and spiritually, it was in ruins, and it was going to be restored. So there's a restoration, you could say a reclamation, among the Jews, those who would accept the Messiah. I need to say a little bit more about this. Remember Jesus said in John, destroy this temple, this house, and I'll raise it in 3 days. And people misquoted him at his trial. And they said that he was threatening the temple itself. But by the temple, he referred to his body. So those who look to a third temple, a physical structure, are deeply misguided. The Jews who do that, the Christians and the Messianics, that's just not right. Restoration of Israel is underway through the ministry of first century leaders like Peter. And as a result, and also as an effect, a consequence, the Gentile mission is really taking off through people like Paul. Let me give one more example of a spiritual or figurative understanding of a passage that we might be tempted otherwise to interpret in a very Jewish way. And this is from Micah chapter 4. And by the way, you'll see a very similar passage in Isaiah chapter 2. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now, the way that's described, it sounds like the Gentiles are all going to Jerusalem. Remember, please, in Greek and in Hebrew, the word peoples or nations or Gentiles, all the same word. Sounds like they're going to Jerusalem to hear the word. And that last sentence, out of Zion the law shall go forth, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. When Peter preaches at Pentecost, he indicates that these latter days or these last days have already come. Look at the way he quotes Joel in Acts 2:16 and 17. In fact, the apostles' ministry from Pentecost on, it's all taking place in the last days. The last days is a period that is still going on right now. But the house of the Lord being established on the mountains happened not in a physical way. There was no physical structure being built. The early church understood this passage I just read, Micah 4, or the parallel in Isaiah chapter 2, as referring to the church. And the Gentile mission, not fulfilled by Gentiles coming to Jerusalem, so much as by the word going out from Jerusalem to Judea, Samaria, and eventually the ends of the earth, which Rome was considered, spiritually speaking, although it was the center of the earth if you were a proud Roman. So from this passage, we see that there's no evidence, there's no need to rebuild a temple. There's a huge need for rebuilding, but it's not a physical temple. All right, let's talk now about the kosher law. We've mentioned circumcision and the third temple. We'll talk about the kosher law and then a few more things. Now, I'm not denying that there may be some nutritional wisdom in the food laws of Leviticus 11. Generally, avoiding blood and fat is good advice. If you see roadkill, don't pull over for a snack. Eating the meat of animals that have just died that you come across, that's forbidden. Sure, there's wisdom there. There's also great wisdom in vegetarianism. And some people make a good argument that that must be God's will for us because Adam and Eve didn't seem to eat meat in Eden. However, Jesus declared all foods clean, Mark 7:19. 1 Timothy 4, verses 3 and 5 contain a warning from Paul against those who want to say that we can't eat this or that, we have to follow certain food rules. In Hebrews, the writer says in chapter 9, verse 10, they are only a matter of food and drink and various ceremonial washings, external regulations applying until the time of the new order. Well, we're in the new order right now. There's another passage that applies to a kashrut, the kosher laws, and that's in Hebrews 13, 9. Do not be carried away by all kinds of strange teachings. It's good for our hearts to be strengthened by grace, not by eating ceremonial foods, which is of no benefit to those who do so. We have an altar from which those who minister at the tabernacle have no right to eat. Now, when the Hebrew writer is speaking, there's no tabernacle. He's referring to the temple under that old word. You know, in the time of Moses, that would have been accurate. But he says quite clearly, what we eat... does not follow the rules and guidelines of the priests in Jerusalem. Our hearts are strengthened by grace, not by eating clean food as opposed to unclean foods. So there's not only no evidence that we're to be kosher as Christians, but there are a number of passages that go against it. And Mark 7:19 just seems to settle it quite clearly. Well, let's look at a few more of the teachings that are found in most parts of Messianic Judaism. One is that we should separate from the Gentile church. And I'm not saying that all Messianics teach that, but some do. That is, a Gentile church, one that is either not Jewish or that doesn't agree with their interpretation of Torah, is still binding. But that really doesn't work because of what the Bible says in Romans and Matthew and John and Galatians and many other places, like Galatians 3, 28, 29. There is no distinction between Jew and Gentile. We're all children of faith, children of Abraham by faith. So to separate, to create a Gentile church and a Jewish church is just not right. We have parallels in our own time. It would be as wrong as saying, okay, we're just going to have a white church, and if anyone else wants to come, they can build their own church. I don't think we would accept that. Another teaching, which is quite common among Messianics, is that the New Testament was originally written in Hebrew. I first came across this odd teaching on my first visit to Israel. I remember that, January 97. And the fellow I was with had a Hebrew New Testament. It was well-worn. And I asked him, how was the translation made? You know, because there are no ancient Hebrew New Testaments. And he seemed to admit, yeah, they must have used the Greek. But he said, this is the original. That's quite an interesting thought, because most scholars believe Jesus taught in Aramaic. Hebrew would have been retained by the rabbis, but Aramaic was the language of the common people. But the New Testament's not written in Aramaic. Now, there are a few times when Aramaic words are given and normally translated. Words like Talitha Kum and Ephatha and so forth, Maranatha, Eloi Eloi Lema Sabachthani, because the people who are reading the New Testament were familiar with Greek, but not necessarily Aramaic. So scholars believe Jesus taught in Aramaic. A minority allow that maybe Matthew was originally written in Hebrews. There's a second century comment on that's possible. But even if it was, all the other documents were written in Greek. Why Greek instead of Aramaic or Hebrew? Because it was the common language of the empire, and the point was to get the word out. The New Testament was not originally written in Hebrew, though obviously today, for those for whom that is a first language, like in Israel, then they need it translated into Hebrew, and they've got it. Another teaching, and this is not as common as the belief that the New Testament's in Hebrew, is that you shouldn't have communion during the Sunday service. So some would separate it out. Most Messianics do not celebrate Easter or Christmas because they're not in the Bible, or they're unbiblical or commercial. Many of their observations are correct. Their approach is almost identical to that of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Celebrating Christmas could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. It just depends. But the Bible simply doesn't say. Here's one that is extremely common among Messianics, and that's their reliance on the Talmud. I'll have to explain what the Talmud is in just a second. But they look at passages in the Talmud as shedding significant light on how Jesus trained the 12 and what's expected of Christians today. Now, Talmud just means what is taught. Lamed is the word meaning to teach. Talmud is the teaching. It includes sayings and stories and ideas, all kinds of things. There are two parts. There's the Mishnah and the Gemara. Now, the Mishnah is the oral law. The Pharisees in Jesus' time believed that Moses got the written law, but up on Mount Sinai, he also received the oral law. It was never written down, but they preserved it. I've read the Mishnah. It's a huge collection of sayings and arguments on multiple areas of life. There's six tractates: seeds, festivals, women, damages, holy things, and purity. Seeds is about prayer, blessings, and tithing, and agriculture. The second tract on festivals is on the Sabbath and the festivals. These are very Jewish things. The third one is called Nashim. It's on women. It's on marriage and divorce and oaths. The fourth one is on damages, as in criminal torts. So it's on courts and torts and oaths and civil law and criminal law. And then you've got holy things. That's the fifth tractate on the temple and kashrut and sacrificial rites. And the last one's on purity, the various laws of purity and impurity. That's the Mishnah. So that's the oral law. And the Talmud is elaborates on that. The Gemara, the other part, contains even more stories about biblical characters. Most of these are just legendary. Speculations about the world to come, arguments about the law. And so you have the Talmud containing the Mishnah, that is the oral law, and the Gemara, which is the completion. Now, there are two Talmuds. The Jerusalem Talmud was finished around 400 AD, Babylonian Talmud later, and it's also much bigger. That was finished more like 500, even up to 700 AD. So my question is, how accurately can we read practices described in these early medieval documents into the first century AD? Just because it was done this way in Talmudic times doesn't mean it was done that way in the first century, because there's often a wide gulf between theory and practice, isn't there? Between the ideal and the real. For example, in the Talmud, rabbis would make disciples of boys. So messianics and many who share some of their teachings would say that Jesus' apostles were boys. John may have been as young as 9. Peter, perhaps 18, was the oldest. I think that's very unlikely. But the problem is they're reading the New Testament through the lens of something that's not committed to writing until centuries later. And centuries later was a long way from the world of the New Testament. Oh, another thing that you'll often hear, they'll say that rabbis made their disciples memorize the Torah. And so the apostles of Christ would have memorized the Old Testament, or at least the Torah. Again, I don't see any evidence of that. Because after that war with Rome, 70 AD, all versions of Judaism were stamped out except one. The stricter Pharisees were no more, the Shammaites. The Essenes, the ones who lived down at the Dead Sea and the Dead Sea Scrolls, those people, they're gone. The Herodians, the Sadducees, they're all gone. After 70 AD, there's only one group of Jews remaining, and that's the more liberal Hillel school, the Hillelite Pharisees, the direct ancestors of rabbinical Judaism. And so to look at something that's been written in the year 400 or 500 or 600 AD, and then assume that whatever they describe, that's the way Jesus did it, I think that's a huge leap. And Messianic Judaism doesn't really read the ancient sources critically, not critically enough. Let me add in one more thing before we close. And it's a bogus argument I've heard, and maybe you've heard too, that the law, the Torah, must still be in effect, because otherwise God would have changed, and God doesn't change, Malachi 3:6. So if God doesn't change, then he wouldn't have changed the law. But that's to confuse God's nature and character with how he relates to others or what he requires. Changes in law or covenant do not mean that the divine being has to change. Next time, we'll be looking at Romans, Galatians, the Jew-Gentile controversy, and the Israel of God. Thanks for listening.